You're watching Deprogrammed. This is the New Culture Forum show committed to fighting back against the forces of ideological conformity, particularly among the young. My name's Harrison Pitt. I'm a senior editor at the European Conservative, and I'm thrilled to be joined today, as ever, by Evan Riggs, who is a freelance journalist, and our special guest this week, Ben Sixsmith, a must-read writer, polemicist, and online editor at The Critic. Now, Ben, recently we saw the head of the civil service, Simon Case, and MI6 chief, Richard Moore, resign from a gentleman's club in central London because some busybody journalist at The Guardian had exposed them for being members of the Garrett Club, a male-only club. This was considered a affront to the religion of our time, namely diversity, equity, and inclusion. Do you agree with those people on the right who argue that this is, to some extent, the feminization of society in action?
I do. I mean, on the one hand, I don't really care about their club. I mean, there's almost something obscene about the fact that these very powerful guys are just gathering together to, you know, pat each other on the back over all the wonderful things they've been doing for the world. Mm. I mean, I think sometimes the only club they deserve is the one beating them over the head. So I don't have that much sympathy. But on the other hand, in a kind of more meta sense, mm-hmm. it is clearly an attempt to suggest that there can be no distinction between the sexes. There can be no spaces in which men and women cannot kind of occupy time separately, mm. and just denying that there are any kind of social / psychological differences that make people want to spend time separately. Mm. I mean, I don't know how many women wanted to be in the Garrett Club to begin with, and who was like, "I've just got to be in there with Simon Case. We're going to have a great time." But it's more of a kind of devious attempt to deconstruct a norm, mm. I guess, than it is a sincere attempt to join these gentlemen's clubs.
Mm. Do you think that the certainly it's completely consistent with a lot of the blank slateism that defines the left, this idea that we're all fundamentally indistinguishable, undifferentiated, radical, autonomous individuals, and the only thing that makes us different are precisely these sorts of social structures like the Garrett Club, and therefore in the interest of liberation, these things need to be stamped out, every vestige of difference. It can't be natural, it can't be based in the social and psychological things that you talk about. It must be a social construct of some kind, an invidious one, and one to be stamped out. But that's clearly the ideological motivation which you're speaking about there, the egalitarianism of it. But do you think that it speaks to do you think that to some extent that egalitarianism is parasitic on the fact that our society is being increasingly feminized? I mean, this is something that people like Eric Kaufman have entertained. It's something that people like, who's that chap who lost his place at professorship at Cambridge for doing research in areas that were...
Noah Carl
has written about this as well. What do you make of that thesis?
Yeah, I mean, the fact that they've apologized and left this club is proof enough mm. that any kind of notion of traditional masculinity, you know, standing behind your words, standing behind your values, mm-hmm. I presume standing behind your friends. I mean, they're effectively saying that their friends who they've been yes. drinking with in this club for years are worse people than they are.
Yes.
Or they wouldn't be there as well.
So that's a good point.
It's that they embody that kind mm. of abandonment of character.
Mm.
Not just kind of masculinity in kind of chest beating sense, but in the sense of a kind of nobility of character and of soul almost.
Mm.
And there, one day I think they were kind of joking about it and saying, oh, it's not a big deal, it's fine. And the next day they've put their tail between their legs because The Guardian said something mildly rude about them.
Indeed.
Mm. It speaks in itself to a kind of spiritual corruption among our wise elite.
I wonder, you know, how these folks are... Anybody who's getting canceled out of anything these days, are like, they're crumbling out of, you know, with the slightest amount of pressure.
Mm.
And like, how we can, you know, kind of impart the message upon these guys of like, if you just ignore it for 3 or 4 days, it will go away and nothing bad will actually happen to you. I think we are kind of in like a post-cancellation era. Like, if you have the kind of fortitude to just like stand by for a little while, you'll be fine. But I'm seeing more and more, and I mean, I think especially in the UK, I think the Americans basically have enough of a kind of alternative ecosystem that you know that you'll have a certain amount of support, of people just like immediately apologizing, immediately getting castigated out. Like, I thought we were kind of beyond this. And I don't know, I mean, you must have taken some slings and arrows for some of the stuff that you've written. What advice would you give to somebody who wants to basically be like, no, I'm standing by this, I'm not backing down on my word?
Yeah, I mean, the people I have sympathy with are the people whose livelihood depends on not being cancelled. Then I have some kind of understanding. Mm. If you're going to lose your job, you have to feed your family. I'm not going to judge someone for being a little bit tactical and diplomatic. But obviously that's not the case here with Mr. Case. I mean, I don't think he's thinking, you know, where is my children's next meal going to come from? I think the message I would say is, I think these people are very concerned about losing status, about losing their kind of prestigious place within society.
Yeah, and but when you look like a cuck, you lose
this is what I'm saying. I mean, what we need to say is, if you are just cowering before the slightest criticism, like you don't deserve any status. I mean, you're making yourself such a less of a person that why is it even worth occupying this position? Because everyone looking at you is going to know that while you might technically occupy this post, there's nothing noble or dignified or impressive about you. So we have to understand that the very act of being submissive in the face of cancellation is going to discredit you in the face of the people who should be respecting you.
And we need to enshrine those as new standards, but it seems to me that in order for those to become the new standards and in order for people to act in accordance with our index, not our index, but like the index that we agree with about what constitutes being a man and what constitutes being a cuck, as Evan put it, it seems to me that you need to reach a critical mass of people just doing that, and you almost sort of, I suppose, live that standard into being. And like, not that he deserves sort of undiluted praise, but this is one thing that Trump is extremely good at in the US, of course. I mean, if anything, the fact that that there's always some kind of headline over something fresh that Trump said. Obviously, the most recent case is probably the bloodbath comment, which was completely taken out of context, and it should go without saying. But regardless of that, you know, because Trump comes out with so many impulsive statements, if anything, it gives him a bit of an advantage, because you don't have time enough to weigh his most recent blunder until he's made another one, and you have to focus on that, and then it just becomes baked into the cake of this is Trump. So no one's really trying to cancel Trump anymore. They're trying, obviously,
he can't.
Yeah. They're going after him with lawfare. But I think you're right. I think if people did stand strong in the face of this sort of stuff, like look at Lee Anderson, he didn't apologize. No one's really talking about the comments he made about Sadiq Khan and his mates running London and all that sort of thing anymore. So, like, it seems to me that people who are not, as you say, you're correct to say this, people who are not financially dependent on being a little bit tactical, a little bit diplomatic, should do the rest of us a solid and try and make it so that these standards do become enshrined at a wider level.
I don't know. I mean, I think if you apologize, like, nobody's going to then be like, oh, okay, well, he apologized. You know what I mean? Like, you never get that. That's never happened once. But then all the people that you're kind of then throwing under the bus, like this guy's mates who are still in the club, they just say, well, like, what good were you to have around? Like, you've just immediately stabbed us in the back. Yeah. I mean, it's a lose-lose maneuver. I don't understand why people keep making it. Nobody's learned the lesson yet.
Yeah. Yeah, it's going to take people just ignoring it, making a joke out of it, doubling down, obviously not doubling down if they're genuinely factually wrong, for example, but doubling down if it is their sincere belief and it's something that they're willing to stand behind, because the more examples we have of people who do just ignore it, the more other people are going to see that it's possible and it's something that we can do. And yeah, it takes leading by example.
Exactly. And but it's funny, it's exactly what you both say about how it doesn't actually do any, all it does is alienate your friends and embolden your enemies if you cave. And I read a Guardian write-up this morning updating their take on it, this really important news item. And it was just dripping with just as much contempt as the original article, and it was sort of emboldened by it. It was saying, this is going to cause a sea change in gentleman club culture, and we're going to have to, you know, push the cause further to make sure that these horrible bastions of male elitism are really stamped out for good. We should be looking into who else is a member of this club. So all it does is, you know, enable that kind of rampaging egalitarian obsessiveness to continue stalking the land and looking for people to take out.
I mean, if there's a school bully and he says, give me a pound or I'll punch you. If you give him the pound, he's not going to say, what a nice guy. we're going to get on in the future. He's going to come back and say, give me £5 or I'm going to punch you.
And everyone else in the school is going to be like, why the hell did you give him £1? Now he's going to be asking me for the same thing. Yeah. And so,
you've shown the chink in your armor. But I guess a follow-up question to all this would be like, why doesn't the right, with maybe the exception of Chris Rufo, ever do this kind of stuff in return? I mean, there's lots of essays being written about, you know, old books or new publications or podcasts or films or all this kind of cultural stuff, which I agree is very important, or like very heady Westminster political drama, but there's never ever like the takedown, which is, you know, not the kind of writing you do, but at the same time, I'm kind of waiting for somebody in Westminster to like take up the cause. I mean, we've lost Steve Edgington now, so the position's open. I mean, what is it that you think about, I don't know, this kind of like Westminster UK cultural right-wing milieu, is that they don't get the idea of, or they haven't learned the lesson again of, you have to basically play by the, you have to play in the terms that are being played against you. You have to, if they're going to do this kind of stuff for gentlemen's clubs, like, why doesn't people look into Hope Not Hate? They're looking into you.
No, absolutely. We don't have enough kind of investigative journalism on the right. This is completely hypocritical because I'm an opinion columnist. It's just like Zebra saying, we need to have more lions. But we do need, because there's so much shady stuff that goes on within left-leaning institutions. And not just in terms of people saying things, but just in terms of kind of ambiguous funding and very clear partisan agendas, a lot of radical political connections which just never get explored. There's a great blog, for example, called SW1 Forum on Substack that does these very detailed investigations of different left-wing institutions. And with a few exceptions, like Steve, you don't find this in the right-leaning press. I think because we're almost too focused on just kind of opinionating, as if politics itself is formed out of these statements that people make. And we don't look enough into the networks that actually kind of drive politics forwards. Obviously, we have this term, the blob. And I think some people confuse it with just like, oh, Owen Jones is the blob. And these kind of pundits, they don't have that much influence.
They don't matter.
You have to look into these groups which are underpinning this punditry and the kind of stuff they do, often, not in every case, but often with people's tax money, often, as I say, with fairly questionable connections. So there's a lot more work that needs to be done in that kind of sphere.
Opinion columnist you may be, what advice would you give somebody who came to you and was like, I want to actually start writing, but like not just about what I think about the current subject, but doing a little bit more hard-hitting work about getting published and about putting themselves out there?
Yeah, so I would say, one, be very careful financially, because fundamentally it's not a great way to make your riches. So you've got to think about it materially. Two, I mean, there's just so much publicly available information. You've got to become your own little detective, because most of this stuff isn't secret. You just need to read through documents about funding, about where tax grants are going, or look into these big charities, which I know you've had Poppy Coburn on. She's done a lot of great work on charities and charitable funding and the kind of work that goes into. So you've got to become a little private detective, which is, I mean, it's very fun in itself. I would say, if you want to get it into kind of the broader press, there's a lot of work you can just do on social media. If you can find the sufficiently punchy way of framing what you're interested in. I know you had Jack Anderton on.
I was about to mention him,
Who's developed very organic prominence with his videos on social media.
Indeed.
So
indeed.
If you can build your own platform well enough, you're going to get that kind of mainstream attention.
Yes.
Rather than if you're like, oh, I want to be published in the Times tomorrow, which often should happen, but fundamentally isn't going to happen. So being clever with presentation.
This is one of the regrettable aspects of having lost Steve. We should say, by the way, that Steve Edgerton isn't dead. He's just off to DC,
which is even worse.
Yeah.
I mean,
it's an underworld of sorts. He was someone who was, because you're right, like, not only people like Jack Anderton, who we've had on, and people like Poppy Coburn, who, like, Poppy Coburn writes mainly for, I think, for The Critic and for the bit for The Telegraph and for IM 1776 and those sorts of things. And Jack Anderton obviously does his TikTok stuff, his Instagram stuff, I assume, as well, all that kind of piece this to camera. But there's also quite a fertile and often extremely intelligent and thoughtful and sober anonymous sphere on Twitter, where a lot of this sort of off-grid investigative stuff happens. You get sort of off-grid social science magazines cropping up as well. The only difficulty is how do you? I would imagine that most of these people are probably working, because they're anonymous, they're probably working in the private sector, and they don't want to be rumbled. They don't want their families to be.
Well, I mean, this is a problem for, you know, asking people to speak up, which is often coming from folks that are, you know, basically they've already been canceled and they've kind of, they're insulated from the effects. You know, they now make their living from, you know, speaking their mind. And then you go to some normal person, or you go to like this anonymous guy on Twitter who might be like working as like an accountant or a software engineer or something like this, and being like, oh, just say this stuff, like just change your Twitter handle. It's like, well, and then what? This person will be cast out, and there's nowhere for them to land. Mm. You know, one of the things that I wanted to ask you, Ben, is, you know, we're starting to see it more in the US, where there's like enough kind of funding and enough institutions to like, you can land somewhere. Like, it might be a bit rough, but you'll be okay. But I don't see that in the UK really coming up at all. I mean, I don't see any sort of safety net here for any of the Anons or any of the young up and coming commentators, where it's like, if you actually do say what you really think, what people are, you know, begging you to do, will you be okay? I mean, you brought up the finances thing yourself. There's not a lot of money in this game. I mean, if you're not a pure zealot and in it for the ideology, you know, there's not much left to hang on to.
That's true. And I should have said, a lot of the best of these kind of people are Anons. Mm. One FDMO is worth, you know, 10 times journalists.
Yeah, yeah.
Partly because I think they don't have the kind of financial interest. It is just something they're really interested in, and they pursue it very well and deserve a lot of credit for that, because mm-hmm. you don't want the people who have the real names walking in and basking in the glory. But I mean, yeah, when people are cancelled, it's true, we don't have the institutional support so much. I think, I mean, we have to support each other fundamentally. Mm. If it is, we were talking about kind of friendship and loyalty, if it is someone that we know, unless they've done something, you know, criminally heinous, we have to show some kind of solidarity, to borrow a word from our friends on the left.
Yes.
And help these people. But I mean, also the kind of people who fund right-wing institutions maybe need to have another think about how sensibly they use the money, and how this could be a very profitable kind of avenue of making a difference. Mm. So not just funding people to commentate, but giving people the freedom to do this kind of important work that otherwise they might not have the power to do.
I think it actually can be very financially viable in the right way. But also, I mean, if you look at Mackenzie Scott, formerly known as Mackenzie Bezos, who just gave like $640 million of her ex-husband's money away to like all these like nonprofits and NGOs. And it's like, there is no right wing, you know, and it's not an investment. Right, that money is just
she's not going to be turning a profit off that.
Exactly, she's not asking for anything in return. She's just like, take it, do whatever you will with it. There is no real equivalent on the right that I know of, somebody who's doing that, with basically not saying like, here's what I want to get out of it, but rather, let me basically, you know, kind of, I guess she's investing in the world that she wants to make. But whereas you know, the right, it always ends up just being you know, okay, well, how many column inches am I going to get out of this? It's like, it's not really the point. Mm-hmm. The point is that you won't have this kind of sphere of influence around you if there's nothing supporting it. It'll just crumble at the first quake.
Another thing that I worry about in ideological terms, so we were talking about sort of, you know, personal loyalty here, all these sorts of things that are all very important. But one of the things that I'm often concerned about is that even when the right does leap to the defense of people in cases like this, obviously the one we're talking about here, the Moran case, we tend to defend them in terms which are slightly petrified and slightly nervous, and will kind of, well, no, I'm not defending them.
Defending their freedom.
I'm just defending their freedom to do what they did. And so what often happens in that case is that what you're really doing is you're invoking certain kind of soft liberal standards, and often the standards that the left themselves would have invoked 20 years ago in order to make the defense. And as I've said before, both in print and here, if you're obviously that's not actually a winning game at the moment, but if you are winning on the terms set out by your enemies, in a much larger sense, you're losing monumentally, because all you're doing is entrenching their standards in public discourse. This is particularly noticeable when you get people say things which can technically and philosophically be true and conceptually be true, but still tactically leave much to be desired. It's people saying things like, the left are the real racists. You know, that's a classic archetypal example of invoking their standards to try and beat them, which actually secures their victory.
Well, don't you know that the Conservatives are more diverse in the party
exactly,
of women?
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. We had the first woman, we had the first ethnic minority, all this sort of thing. And I really detest that. Do you think that people should have leapt to the defence, or should leap to the defence of these men, not just in terms of their right to do it, but in terms of, like, it actually makes perfect sense that there are going to be certain private spheres where men want to be masculine together, and by the same token, where women want to be feminine together. I mean, there are lots of Catholic colleges in the United States in particular, or Christian colleges in the United States in particular, which are usually quite expensive to go to, but they take in both men and women. And yes, there are mixed events, and they socialize, and they experience a sort of catechistic formation together. But by the same token, there are days when just the boys go off on a day out, all of them together, and there'll be other days where the women do the same thing. Like, this is something which is to be celebrated, isn't it?
Yeah, completely. I mean, I think every man with friends has specifically male occasions, and every woman has specifically female social networks. I mean, this is such a ubiquitous fact that it's preposterous to deny that there is a kind of average distinction here. So I mean, we shouldn't just be saying that they have this kind of abstract right to do it. We should be saying, well, yeah, I mean, it's often a healthy thing. Not always, of course. That would be pretty weird if we were always segregated. But I mean, often you'll hear gender critical feminists often talking about the right to these single sex spaces and the need for these single sex spaces. And I appreciate that there's an element of safety there, which
of course
doesn't apply to gentlemen's clubs.
Simon Case
was not worried about
it being.
But there is social virtues to it, and I don't think anyone could look over their own friends and sincerely say.
Yeah, but it's one of the beautiful things about the fact that men and women aren't the same, but we are complementary, and so that's why it's important that we should definitely have occasions where, and obviously in the past this would have been, I suppose, there would have been the town ball or the barn dance that in the United States, there were these sorts of things where you would get the sexes mixing together. But there would equally be, after a meal, men would go off and have some cigars, and women would, do whatever they do. I'm not too sure what they do. But this is a beautiful
clean up.
There we go. That's the caption. Yes. This is a beautiful thing. It seems to me that the other thing that I would point out personally that I do enjoy unisex spaces as well. One thing I have noticed is that sometimes if you're in a group with lots of different men and there's one woman in the room, it radically alters the dynamic, just one. Because all of a sudden men, obviously if everyone's single in the room as well, there's going to be a certain amount of, like, everyone trying to impress, people being slightly different, being a little bit more conscious of the fact that the female presence in the room just changes the dynamic in ways. And I'm sure that's the same thing with women, like when there are things that women won't say when there's a man around. And like, it just seems to me that this is just such an obvious social fact about human beings, that it's something that which we should be protecting. And going to the general point, I take it you agree with me that we should be much more stalwart in not only trying to beat the left within their own paradigm, but trying to expand that paradigm and trying to get some of our own ideas in.
Yeah, completely. I mean, you'll often see when people are defending people who've been the subject of condemnation, it'll be kind of, well, they were taken out of context, or, you can't judge them by the standards of those times. And I mean, sometimes that applies. So Trump's bloodshed comment?
There'll be a bloodbath
comment. Like, what genuinely was taken out of context.
Massively.
So it does happen, but we also have to be prepared when we actually do agree with what someone said, or at least when we think it's, within the boundaries of debatable opinion, not just kind of legally legitimate opinion.
Yep.
We can't get too kind of cringy and legalistic, as if we're the advocate for someone that we know did a crime, but we're trying to plead leniency and say, no, Your Honor, he doesn't deserve 5 years, he does two.
Yeah, exactly.
Because, otherwise we are affirming the standards that people are being cancelled by.
Indeed.
We're just trying to find little get-out clauses where they don't necessarily apply to us.
Yeah, I wonder what... this is kind of a US-focused example, but I wonder, it's not enough to always just defend. It's kind of encroach or be encroached upon. So I wonder what, the instantiation of, single-sex spaces would look like. I mean, at least you've got J.K. Rowling backing up the girls in this country, but what would actually kind of reinvesting into men's spaces be? Would you create that fraternal club that got a bunch of bad press in the US for being like, you had to be like a Christian and a father to join it or something like this.
I actually don't agree.
Working out? What would it?
I mean, well, the one thing, this goes back to the point that Ben was making earlier, like precisely because these are natural instincts that people have, I don't think it actually requires much in the way of promotion. Mm-hmm. And I think this is precisely because the left are always, like not always, but because particularly like in the modern age, the left is sort of fundamentally utopian, and the thing which distinguishes the left, I would say, from the right, and anthropologically, is the fact that the right thinks that there are certain aspects of human nature which are really just non-negotiable and you have to work with them, whereas the left has a tendency to regard human beings as infinitely malleable through sort of just changing the social structures. I think it's precisely because the right does have that different anthropological vision that you don't actually need to promote. Like you were just going to get these sorts of single-sex spontaneous spaces emerging spontaneously, and likewise you're going to get men and women mixing spontaneously, like Kissinger's point, like there's never going to be a true war between the sexes because there's too much fraternizing with the enemy, like that, which it was what Kissinger said during the women's movement in the late 1960s. So I'm not sure that this stuff does need promotion. What do you have in mind?
Oh, I have no idea. That's why I figured it was a question. But
do you think it needs promotion, though?
Well, yeah, I would caution against that mentality because it's like, what's the line from Gordon McIntyre? Like the side that wants to win always beats the side that wants to be left alone. Mm-hmm. It's like the side that wants to win always beats the side that thinks that their victory is like inevitable. Mm-hmm. You know, and I think, you know, it's one thing to say like, yes, men and women will inevitably sort into different groups, and yes, they will inevitably come together and conjugate. But like, I do think that it's not enough to basically say like, we have the superior, you know, viewpoint on humanity and we know that this is inevitable. You have to actually build something for people to go to. Like you have to build a club, or you have to build a sports team, or you have to do something like this, and like actively promote it, because it doesn't matter if, you know, you build a gentleman's club or whatever, and 99 times out of 100 that the Guardian writes a hit piece about you, everybody stands firm. The one time that they get you and they chip away a little bit, if they just do that over and over and over again and you're not shoring up your walls, mm-hmm. eventually the whole thing will just completely erode.
Yeah, let me be clear. I definitely agree that under the current circumstances, I'm not saying that this is not a recipe for political quietism. I'm not taking refuge in human nature to say that we shouldn't do anything politically. But the point you raised is that should we go further than defending? And it just seems to me that we don't need to do more than that. And that is still a positive act, like to defend these sorts of things and to, you know, like wherever necessary. I'm all in favor of fighting political battles to make sure that these spontaneous patterns of human life can continue uninterrupted. And I definitely don't think that they will continue uninterrupted inevitably, particularly when you have a sort of rampaging left on the march. But it's not entirely clear to me that we need to. I mean, I wouldn't be against it. What do you think?
I mean, you have to do it in a way that's not too contrived, because if you just set out to be like, all right, guys, yeah. we're having a guys' meeting, we're going to eat bacon and watch football, yeah. and, you know, it's going to just seem very hammy. And
no, and it doesn't even need to be explicitly political, but it could just be, you know, we're going to have, like a group for like working out or something like this. Like, I frequently think that like 25-year-old kid who founded like Gymshark has probably done more for the right wing in this country than like any commentator, simply because, you know, physical fitness is, you know, the first step to fascism, as the Guardian might tell you.
Yeah.
You know, it's just something like that where it's not political.
No, I agree.
But it does kind of in an oblique and, you know, a curious way promote your cause.
I completely agree with that. I think, yes, and under those circumstances, the role of a conservative government, which we don't have, would be to make sure that these things can thrive, but not necessarily to, in the sort of ham-fisted way that Ben satirized, like go around, say, you know, just being too, as you put it, contrived and deliberate about it, which could be counterproductive, and it, particularly when something seems to have the stamp of approval from some, you know, boffin in 10 Downing Street, that's not exactly going to lend credibility.
It needs to be centered, or as you say, around kind of genuine passions. Mm. Like, men don't just meet to be like, I just need to be with men. It's because they have something they want
sometimes.
To do. Well, maybe, yeah.
I live in Brighton.
Sometimes. I don't think we're going to promote that too much. When people are gathered together around exercise, for example, or even if it's just drinking sherry and smoking cigars
They made it laughing
evilly about their private conspiracies in gentlemen's clubs.
They made it sound very I'm sure inadvertently they made it sound very appealing in The Guardian when I read it, because obviously this is supposed to, in their own readership, this is supposed to evoke feelings of like absolute contempt and sort of, oh my gosh, this is just intolerable. But it says, a central London club with its billiard rooms, libraries, bars and multiple dining rooms staffed by writers in pristine white. Like, you know, this is the sort of furnishings which a certain type of man enjoys. And
point I guess I'm mostly trying to make is I would caution against the online anonymous types or the compulsive writers out there or whatever. It's like your 15-point plan about like the origins of like wokeness or something, or your obsession with like old PDFs like might be very interesting on like a personal level, but you'd probably be better off joining the local football club
into
promoting your cause and like having friends and like building like a social network than like writing another 10,000 tweets.
I mean, any kind of political movement needs a heavy social element to build kind of trust, to build loyalty, just to build connections. And outside of politics, all people need that kind of socializing. It's what we don't have so much today because people are glued to their phones, and the price of beer in London, I mean, I visit here for 3 days and I think I need to remortgage my flat.
Yeah.
So we need to promote that kind of social existence. Or what are we doing?
For those that don't know, you live in Poland now. Do you see like a massive difference in Poland, you know, outside of the cities? Do you see the kind of like more harmonious return to nature, or like people are actually being people? Or is it still very much that everybody's glued into their phones and they can't escape the whatever you might want to call it, the empire?
Yeah, I mean, I think the kind of idealized trad conception of Poland, which doesn't exist so much now, but it certainly used to, was kind of these rolling wheat fields and women in low-cut dresses churning butter, and that is all just fantasy.
Even 2 years ago, people kept going on like, let's all move to Warsaw, whatever, like look at the rents, like Poland's like this like based utopia. That does seem to have basically
I think there is more healthy social life. I think it's a safer place generally. I think the costs are somewhat lower. Obviously, also wages are lower, so sometimes that doesn't make sense for some people. But if you do happen to be lucky enough or hardworking enough to have a good job, sometimes the costs of this kind of social existence are low.
One thing, I was in Poland, I think 6 months ago or so, and I was impressed by that. They have a pretty vibrant, which isn't a word that I like to use very often, but they have a pretty vibrant night economy as well, which we don't have in this country, as I understand it. Usually most pubs I think close at around 10 o'clock or 11 o'clock, whereas in Poland I was impressed that, and I guess it was like a Tuesday night as well in Warsaw, and you know, the places were open, still bursting with life until 1 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah, and I think it's in many areas, not in all, but in many areas, it's just a more pleasant place to be. I mean, I don't want to sound too oikophobic, but I'm walking through SW1 and it's like the smell is just alternating between urine and marijuana and so many people, sad people sleeping in the streets and kind of very obvious drug addicts rambling across the road, and it's heartbreaking. I'm not saying that to make fun of them.
No.
It also, it doesn't make you feel, wow, I really want to hang out and spend a lot of time out here.
Indeed. It's interesting you brought up the trad aesthetic about Poland. I think it's better, I think this goes back to what you're saying. It's better that people nourish, I would rather people glorified as an ideal the trad aesthetic than the work aesthetic. Obviously, I think that's better. But I think one of the points that you're making, and I'm agreeing with, and what I was trying to say earlier talking about why men like to go to gentlemen's clubs, why men like to play pool, why men like to do these sorts of things. I wonder, and what is implicit in Evan's point is this idea that certain conservative attitudes are not, for most people, intellectual. They tend to be downstream from certain activities in which they engage. And that's what you're saying when you're saying that the Gymshark guy has probably done more for conservatives than many commentators, because without knowing it, the people who are
or fertility doctors.
Indeed. Yeah. And it seems to me that one of the problems with the trad wife aesthetic, or like whatever it is, like on TikTok, you know, this sort of like manosphere stuff where you're kind of glorifying you know, how did you put it? A woman churning butter in sort of
in a sundress in a wheat field, holding three babies at the same time.
It's not real. It's a commodification of something which should be real, and it's not completely obvious to me that it's causal.
It's lifestyle. It's lifestyle porn for people who live in apartments.
Yeah. It seems to be, and so that's one of the reasons why you're probably right that we do need to try and make sure that we give as much investment as we can to those sorts of activities and which will reap ideological dividends in the future.
And I mean, we do need to have things to aspire towards as well.
Sure.
So there's not necessarily anything wrong with an element of fantasy, only in as much as for many of us, we see modern lives as being sufficiently depressing that we can't just offer the same modern life. There needs to be an idealized aspect. Indeed. But there has to be something that's achievable, because otherwise, even if you try to pursue this and you don't just kind of wallow in the dreamlike atmosphere of it, you're just not going to get there. Mm. I mean, you're not going to get to your homestead with your farm full of sheep and your wife with six kids, material, and inexplicably skinny body. It's not going
to
happen.
Material conditions need to be favorable to it. Sorry.
I was just going to say, certainly not an SW1. It's like, basically all the people who are living in, the surrounding kilometers around us, who are writing, essays and having these extremely articulated opinions, which I'm not denigrating that. I obviously am a part of it and I quite like it, but you're not going to have a home. Like, you're not going to have a family within this thing. Like, you will have to actually go outside of it to create this lifestyle. I think it's a hard reality for people like you, all of us really, to accept too, because you will end up having to make a choice.
Yes. We talk a little bit about the generations here, because Ben, you've written quite a bit about this in the past. So I'm a Zoomer. I think you're a millennial.
Yeah.
I think you're just a millennial.
I'm a Zillennial.
You're right on the cusp. Do you think that there, insofar as you've looked into it, do you think that there are significant attitudinal differences between these two groups, and how can the right, broadly speaking, take advantage of whatever they happen to be?
I think Zoomers are more captivated by kind of fantasy. Not fantasy like Marvel movies. Generally, that's the kind of sad millennial who just wishes he was eight again. But the fantasy kind of aesthetic in very different ways. So like right-wing Zoomers will often be very intensely, fiercely right-wing. But then on the other hand, kind of 14-year-old, well, I don't think that'll be a Zoomer anymore, whatever. A teenage goth Zoomer is going to be very intensely aesthetically gothic. They really commit to these kind of alternative identities almost as a kind of brand, which I think is healthier than the millennial thing, which was more kind of just attaching yourself to a kind of product or a kind of band or a movie franchise. As much as there are really negative aspects of this obsession with identity nowadays and what it's done to kind of conceptions of gender and politics, there's almost something healthy about it where people are at least aspiring towards being an individual in some sense. Whereas I think among millennials, there was much more kind of depressed, we're not really going to amount to anything.
Yeah, millennials are much more cynical. Zoomers are much more ideological, which is going to be very interesting how that, if that shifts or stays the same over the next 15 years and the Zoomers start coming into power. I mean, we might be in a real, sort of war of the gods situation here, where it's the sensible center is completely eroded and basically all that's left is like fanatical Zoomers on both sides.
But where does the cockwomble come into this? And explain what a cockwomble is to... what I should say. One of my favorite pieces written by Ben Sixsmith is that you just type it into Google, notes on cockwomble, and it'll tell you everything you need to know in much greater detail than we can do justice to here. But in any case, because those tend to be from just before the millennial came into their own. But they're still probably having an outsized influence on political discourse in this country. They're the kind of people I would imagine who watch Rory Stewart's and Alistair Campbell's podcast and find it just a breath of fresh air.
Well, I think those are slightly older people. The kind of,
you think?
This is not my term, but it's what some people have called Brit poppers.
Mm.
Like somewhere after you would have got baby boomers in the USA.
Yeah.
Kind of born around late 50s, early 60s. The kind of pinnacle of it is just David Aronovich. He is the embodiment of Brit popper, where it's kind of very complacently liberal, and they have this kind of sense of the process of politics being so important. And if only we had, if only we had X as prime minister, everyone would just be decent and you know, normal and centrist. And then Cockwomble comes from people online who thought there was nothing funnier than using this kind of polysyllabic swear words and just ruined the art of swearing because they thought they kind of made swearing nerdy, which was much worse than just being boorish and crass because you take all of the emotion out of it if you're saying.
There's nothing worse than somebody when somebody tries to swear.
Absolutely. Yeah. And they're like, oh, you wank puffin. It's like, where's the energy in that? It's just pathetic. But how I use it is to describe a certain kind of, I'd say kind of Gen X verging into millennial.
So, but does that not overlap with the Brit poppers?
To some extent.
Okay, right.
To some extent. Because it's not just a generational thing.
It's an attitude
thing. But it's a combination of kind of intense idealism and intense nihilism where everything is bad with the world, but you also can't really do anything about it. So it's just this very impotent railing online about the bloody Tories, bloody bankers, bloody, you know.
Bloody bonuses.
It's
disgusting.
And the kind of people who wanted to be. I think the archetypal Cockwomble is someone who really wanted to be a comedy writer and never made it and is just reduced to railing bitterly against the world.
Who are the talismanic figures of Cockwomble?
So one of them online is a guy called James Felton who's written various books with mild swear words in the title. But it's generally they don't have like
52 times Britain was a bell end.
Absolutely.
That sort of thing. Yeah.
Absolutely. And often they'll have kind of Simpsons characters in their profile pictures and they'll just be you're saying, you know, Rishi Sunak is, I don't know how much I can swear on this stage.
Well, it's a bit late. You did say wank puffin.
But I think the kind of the way they influence debate is just to make everything negative, but not in a kind of productive, this is a social problem, what are we going to do about it sense.
Yes.
But just this kind of drumbeat of hostility towards anyone who's actually trying to do anything.
Yeah.
And I mean, obviously, generally on the right, because like, they tend to be leftist people.
So Cockwombles tend to be on
the left.
And they resent people on the right who are trying to do something, you mean?
Absolutely. Yeah.
But James O'Brien probably is.
He falls
into this as well. Like, what are his main Cockwomble-ish features?
How he just, like, he has this very clear sense of how the world should be. And if anyone believes anything different, then there just cannot be anything redeemable about their intellect or morality. They just every time you see James O'Brien, he's just got this pained expression on his face, and anyone who's saying something to him, one of his callers, and he's like, and I mean, if someone was saying acting like that, and you were talking to them in front of them, you'd slap them in the face. I mean, it would just be insufferable. So just this kind of. This kind of spiritual agony at any kind of disagreement is the defining feature of the Cockwomble. And I mean, they're not generally. I just dislike them. So that's I'm not sure how influential they are.
You just have a sort of an instinctive visceral reaction to them, and you just try and justify that ex post facto with all of these.
Well, I think if I can kind of give a word for their significance. It's the kind of people we have to use to say these left-wing ideas actually in many ways are very unattractive. Like I think there's a tendency on the right to be like, yeah, all of these left-wing ideas, they're wonderful, they just don't work. Like they're great, you know, these leftists are all really high status and cool and they're just impractical. Whereas I think we need to focus more on how unattractive and bitter and
deservedly low status.
Deservedly low status. Not even like progressive. As much as I use the term progressive, sometimes it's almost for convenience because this kind of person, there isn't really anything like creative that they want to do in the world. Like maybe they are progressive in the sense that they support open borders or you know redistribution or something. But there's nothing. There's no kind of creative spirit.
They're custodians of mediocrity and decline fundamentally, and that's what the your little, it's actually not very long essay, it's probably only about 800 words or so, it's what it gets across quite well. Notes on Cockwomble, well worth reading, but it ties into another point that I've been thinking about lately, and I'm glad that life expectancy today is much higher than what it used to be, but it seems to, so we, again, Evan, you said earlier that when the Zoomers get in charge, when the hell is that going to be? Because the when life expectancy was much lower, speak in any kind of eugenic sense here, but there was a certain kind of intergenerational hygiene that went on, because there were traditions which are handed down, but every generation would sooner or later find itself in the driving seat, and it would have to consider the problems of the age afresh. And it seems to me that people like James O'Brien, who fall into this sort of Gen X, I mean, we still got the boomers who are sort of running Washington DC for the most part. It's going to be a long time before these ideas kind of sort of make their way onto the conveyor belt, onto a register on the policy screen of government, it seems to me.
I'm not entirely sure that's true. I think, you know, the notable thing about the boomers is that they just won't die or go away. They've been the first generation ever to like really hold on to things long past the time they should have been given up.
Yeah.
And I don't know if Gen X or will have that same issue. I mean, Gen X tends to get overlooked in every single possible way. But I also think that whatever you might want to call it is like Zoomer zealotry has actually started to permeate upwards through the millennials and even into the Gen Xers politically. So I think like the last like sort of like, I don't want to put it into like dramatic terms, like veneer of the, like the marketplace of ideas or all these kind of like tired, like used out or used up and expired ideas will kind of disintegrate when the boomers are finally gone. I think that there will actually be a large amount of change in the next 10 years. And I do think that like even if you look back to like 2016 to now, that wasn't even 10 years ago. Think of how much has changed. And I do think it's getting... The rate of change is getting exponentially faster. So I think the boomers are going to hold on to this kind of stuff for dear life. They're also soon going to be dearly departed. And then a lot will be up on the table for grabs for those with the inclination to seize it.
I think there's some extent to which millennials especially are almost going to be passed over. And I say that as a millennial, so I'm not saying it disparagingly, but there was a kind of... just a cultural flatness. I mean, every boomer looks back at the 60s, or nearly every boomer, as this kind of amazing golden period where, you know, everything was possible. The music was great. The films were great. There's no one who's like, wow, the noughties, what a time. The golden age, it's just not going to happen. And there's a kind of spiritual vacuity there. Obviously not as it applies to individuals, but just generationally, I can't imagine millennials having this kind of this vision.
And have many resources to draw on.
Spirit and resources, to monopolize
spiritual and moral and imaginative.
Whereas Zoomers, not always for the best, but they do have a kind of spiritual energy to them and a kind of aesthetic energy. So they might just be able to kind of almost leapfrog the people who came before.
Yeah, I think like once like the last person finally goes like, oh, can't we just be back to like 1999, like those like golden era? Like once that's basically dead, everything can change. But that will require like a lot of Gen X people to give up and the boomers to die.
Yeah, I once wrote a piece called I Hate the 90s. And it wasn't actually because I don't hate the 90s in a cultural sense, but it's more the memory of the 90s as this kind of, this very competent era when everything had so much, the politicians were effective and, you know, there weren't all of these major crises.
Bill Clinton ran the budget surplus.
Absolutely.
That sort of thing.
Yeah. Absolutely. But then we were building up all of these crises for the noughties. Like it was much more pleasant to live in, but everything was getting worse in an almost imperceptible way. I mean, 9/11, for example, it happened in the noughties, but the roots were in the 90s.
Of course they were. The hunt for bin Laden was taking place prior to 2001.
Absolutely. And I mean, the pure unmitigated evil of Blair was a 90s phenomenon initially. Rather than a noughties phenomenon,
and it was just spilled over into the noughties, and it was sort of rooted in a sort of end of history theology, and the sort of the enthusiasm that went with that, the idea that I think that helped the idea that liberalism had emerged triumphant with the fall of the Soviet Union. And by the way, I should say that Fukuyama's book is actually much more nuanced than this, and well worth reading.
I know, much maligned, poor Francis Fukuyama.
Yeah. I mean, the first section is as people describe it. The second section is much more imaginative about how could this go wrong. But in any case, nevertheless, often it doesn't matter what the book actually says. What matters is the prevailing wave to which it seems to lend force. And I think that led to a sense that certain tried and tested things that we knew about human nature, those sort of aspects of political and civilizational gravity no longer applied to us, and we can kind of just fly and soar triumphantly with our idealism because we've conquered all of the challenges to liberalism.
Well, in the back half of Fukuyama's title that people often don't talk about is, you know, it's the end of history and the last man, right? And we're kind of in the last man era. And I do wonder, you know, how long that can last. I also do think that a lot of the issues that we're talking about are purely like an Anglosphere issue. Like, I don't think the Germans or the Spanish or the French really, like, idolized the 90s and that kind of golden era as much as, like, Brits and Americans do. And I think that without, you know, a lot of the changes that we're now seeing on the continent are basically a result of that. They're not stuck in that 90s paradigm. So it can be broken or subverted. It just might take another couple of years.
The last section of this, let's just gives viewers something potentially positive to think about. Are you optimistic about the next, let's say, 10 years in British politics? I don't mean like, do you think there's going to be a killer law passed in 4 years' time, which is just going to sort everything out? I just mean, like, in general, do you think that the direction of travel on the right, I mean, is fundamentally promising?
I think there's grounds for hope, let's say. It's going to be, in many ways, a good thing that the Conservatives are going to get crushed in the next election. Not because Starmer's going to be any good. I'm sure it's going to be worse. Tom Jones was talking last week about how it's going to be a more oppressive atmosphere for the right, and that's true. The one positive thing is he's going to fail catastrophically. I mean, it's going to be, whether he gets two terms or not, everything is going to keep getting worse. They don't have any plans for anything to do better. They don't have the resources or the kind of civilizational stability that Blair had. And Blair was also much more talented than Starmer. So
Certainly. They're
going to have 4 years of catastrophe upon catastrophe, and we're going to have a lot to work with. As much as now the polling is generally just terrible for us, I think there will be a lot of minds open to being changed over the coming years, because there's going to be so much political failure,
and the terms of the debate will be up for grabs, so to speak. So we will. Is that part of the point you're making?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if you look at how Conservatives, for all that they've done, nothing very useful. Even if you look at how they feel they have to speak now, away from this kind of noughties Cameronism, it shows that they at least have a sense of pressure to be more substantive and more sound. Let's say. Which is not, you know, I'd rather they'd done something, anything useful, but at least it shows a sign of hope for the future.
Because they see where the wind's blowing, to speak. The other thing as well, I wonder, I watched Owen Jones put out a video the other day talking about why he'd left the Labour Party and torn up his Labour Party membership, and he was criticising Starmer, I actually think quite justifiably, on all sorts of things which he promised the Labour membership when he was running against Rebecca Long Bailey a couple of years ago, which he's completely done U-turns on. He's certainly a fairly slippery, vacuous character, and Jones is right about that. But one of the points that Jones does make at one point is that he's terrified. I'm terrified about what's going to happen to the country, because Starmer's going to be awful, he's going to fail, and then the far right is going to be there to pick up the pieces. And by far right, of course, he means people who hold views on immigration indistinguishable from Clement Attlee's, and certainly from John Major's in the 1990s, where immigration was running at just whatever John Major may say about how far right the Conservative Party has become and how terrifying it is. You know, immigration was running at a twelfth of what it is now in the 1990s under his premiership. So there is a promise there. What's your assessment of the lay of the land, Evan?
I don't know. I think that's going to be the story for most Western countries, basically, is that it will continue to kind of ratchet over to the left until there is like this like kind of, I don't know what you want to call it, like accelerationism effect, whereas like as things just get dramatically worse, somebody will come up to pick up the pieces. I don't know, I think Owen Jones is probably right, but good luck stopping it. I think it's more or less inevitable.
But not in the way that he thinks he's right. One thing we might be able to finish on, obviously you spend your time in Europe, you're not a Pole, and so it's not your business, strictly speaking, but there's certainly a wave on the continent of sorts, there's a bit of a dam in Poland at the moment preventing that sort of right-wing wave from taking place. But just considering the continent in general, do you think that it's possible that we might be able to, we're talking about drawing resources from generations being able to draw resources from moments in their shared history, do you think it's possible that we might be able to draw resources from much of what's been going on there and to cash in on some of that sovereigntist, is what the word they use for it, the sovereigntist sort of national democracy type energy?
Yeah, I think so. It's been a strange almost paradox of Brexit, is that in many ways, Britain has drifted to the left, and a lot of European countries have drifted to the right.
Absolutely.
And we don't see that so much in Britain, but I think among a lot of young Remainers, there's this sense of the continent as being more sophisticated, more urbane, and a lot of that is untrue.
Yeah.
But there's almost the potential there for them to see, you know, if they do think of Europe as a much more cultured place, and Europe is becoming more right-wing, maybe they're going to see that and think, oh, you know, maybe it wasn't the sophisticated intellectual thing to be watery leftist. Check. Maybe there's something in what they're saying.
Do you think if Brexit had never happened, you would have seen a similar effect in the UK to what's happened in other European countries?
I don't. There's something about young people in Britain, which I have no idea why, but it's more rigidly leftist that you don't get in other countries, and I'm not sure why. I think maybe if it hadn't been for Brexit, people would have been more discontented quicker, because Brexit kind of gave the Conservatives at least a couple of years of
pretending
grace
they did
didn't
something.
Deserve. Absolutely. Yeah. So, I mean, I don't think any of us would disagree that a driving force for Brexit was immigration, and as soon as it happened, immigration massively went up.
Indeed.
And if it wasn't for Brexit, I think that would have been kind of more obvious, because people hadn't had this win.
This sort of enthusiasm, sort of post-Brexit enthusiasm. Well, we'll have to, I think it's clear that Britain clearly needs some kind of second populist moment, because we wasted the last one. Ben Sixsmith, thank you so much for joining us on Deprogrammed. Evan, thank you as ever. You've been watching Deprogrammed. Make sure to like, subscribe, leave a comment if you wish, and we shall see you on the next one.
Hello. If you're enjoying the New Culture Forum channel and you believe in our mission, may I invite you to join our membership scheme at the link below, or on our website, newcultureforum.org.uk. Our work is more important now than ever, and we have great plans ahead for the future, but we can't do it without your support. From as little as £3 per month, you can help ensure that we continue on our mission. As a member, you'll receive a range of benefits, including access to exclusive content, invitations to our private events, including here at our studios, free copies of our books, and much, much more, including, of course, our famous NCF mug. If you aren't able to become a member, then please help us by clicking this button and subscribing to our channel. It's completely free. Just remember to also click the bell icon so that you can get notifications when we post new videos. Thank you.